Hello and welcome to Sprogcast, a radio show all about pregnancy, birth and early parenting, hosted by Karen Hall and Mark Harris and supported by Pinter and Martin. This is Sprogcast. On episode 23, we're holding our heads in our hands and asking what's gone wrong with the NHS in general and midwifery in particular. We chat to Dr. Margaret McCartney and NCT Senior Policy Advisor Elizabeth Duff to see if they can shed any light on this. But first, here's Mark Harris.
Hi, Karen. I think we also have a birth story.
We do. I'm going to put that on the end to play us out. James Brackenbury.
Yeah, he's a chap that I've kind of worked with as he was preparing for his pregnancy. And I thought it'd be nice to have a birth story from a man's perspective.
He did go on and on about how much he loved you, Mark. I may have edited all that out.
Did you edit all that out? That's why I didn't interview him, Karen. That's why you did it.
But it's just been embarrassing, wouldn't it?
It's a bit like product placement, isn't it? Yeah. I've seen a lot of series just recently and people hold their iPad up to the camera and covert. Well, it's not very covert, is it?
No, not product at all. Placement.
It's kind of like the impact that seeing women birth on the bed has had for generations.
But yeah. Anyway,
it's a covert way of influencing the narrative. And we see that all over the media, don't we?
Yes, and talking of conspiracy theories, I think it's quite interesting later on when we listen to Margaret McCartney's interview, she kind of touches and never quite says, this is all deliberate.
What, the deliberate privatisation of the NHS?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think it's the Illuminati.
Do you not?
I don't think that's going on, but I do think it is this unwavering belief in capitalism.
Yeah.
You know, the free market economy, like the market will regulate itself. Well, that would be fine if the human animal didn't crave security. And the way they get security nowadays is by building their bank balance.
Yes. And it influences everything, doesn't it?
Completely everything. Whether we're talking about vaping rather than, you know, quitting smoking other ways, whether we're talking about breastfeeding rather than formula feeding, underneath it all seems to run this current of making money. And what drives that almost visceral response to feeling insecure if I don't have enough money? Well, I reckon it's our evolutionary history, but that's an old rift.
Yeah, but when you talk about breastfeeding, it doesn't make any sense to me. It can't make sense that if we were able to increase the breastfeeding rates even a tiny bit, you could save millions of pounds for the NHS. And none of that money is ever invested up front in the support that would make it happen.
No. You know, as recent as 2010, the NHS Infant Study Survey suggests that it's only 1 to 2% of babies that are breastfed exclusively up to 6 months.
Yes.
And yet all of the evidence, you know, points towards the long-term benefits, maybe even generational benefits, of increasing our breastfeeding rates. And today we've got something we're going to discuss, which is this the perception of feeding, making a picture of yourself, feeding your baby, and the baby is over two.
Or at any time, people are really funny about pictures of women breastfeeding. I wish I had more pictures of me feeding Conrad. Unfortunately, I was nearly always in my dressing gown with no makeup on, and that is why there are no pictures. I didn't look like Tamara Eccleston. I still don't.
No, wow. Pete loves you.
He's got such low standards.
Well, high standards, I would say. But I don't know. We seem to come back to this theme again and again and again. It's the backlash from people that seem to interpret the picture as a criticism of their feeding choice.
Yeah. Tamara Eccleston doesn't dream of making people shamed. She's posting beautiful pictures celebrating something and perhaps helping a little bit to normalise. But it's not. It's doing the opposite, isn't it? Because of the way people respond to it.
It creates a polarised response. I mean, she makes, I think the quote from her is, breastfeeding has got moralised and politicised. Do you know, I think the vitriol, to a certain extent, is kind of like the projection of inner pain.
Yeah.
Onto the source that has triggered that inner pain.
But it's also a lack of ability to see the big picture because, and I guess the inner pain is part of that, people are so focused on what do I feel about this that they can't see that they've been let down. It's not people, you know, people like me who support breastfeeding and help people to breastfeed aren't deliberately trying to make her feel bad.
No, of course not.
This notional woman. We're not trying to shame her.
No.
Particularly since she's already stopped breastfeeding, and what would be the point of that?
Yeah.
But we want to do a positive thing, and they can't see that big picture that if they were actually, if they just didn't say that polarizing stuff, the whole thing would be easier. And yeah, it might not make a difference to their experience, though they may have another child and it may make a difference then.
Yeah.
But it will make a difference to the other women who come after her.
Yeah, true. The idea that breastfeeding has become a moral issue is a big overarching factor, if you ask me. You know, whether you breastfeed or bottle feed, for me, is rooted in a choice, right? It's not good or bad in a moral sense. But the minute it morphs into a moral issue, then there's loads of room for guilt. And when there's loads of room for guilt, there's room for angry responses.
Well, that's a kind of twofold thing, isn't it? Because it's not an even choice whether to breastfeed or not, because most people who stop breastfeeding are not making a positive decision to do that. They're being pushed into it for one reason or another. They doubt themselves. Somebody else doubts them. Something's gone wrong in some way. Yeah. I can't remember what the other part of my twofold thing was.
No, that's good. It's a multi-level thing. We have spoken to it ad nauseum. You know, we have a cultural narrative that is informed by vested interest. You know, the formula companies are no mugs.
Part of my twofold thing. Yes.
Yeah, well, they know what they're doing when they're shaping the cultural narrative. And they have a vested interest in the acrimony.
They're so very successful in this.
They're good at it.
Listeners, if we're boring you on breastfeeding, please let us know on facebook.com/sprogcast, or you can tell us all about it on Twitter. Won't make the damnedest bit of difference. We're still going to talk about it.
Without a doubt.
Sprogcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Pinter & Martin, an independent publishing company specialising in pregnancy, birth and parenting, psychology, nutrition and yoga, and also some interesting fictional books coming up, including one that sounds fascinating from Alice Allen, and they're at pinterandmartin.com. And they're also supporting us to put on our second Sprogcast Live, which we hope to do on April the 27th at EFRA Space in Brixton in the evening. And we've confirmed two guests so far, Becky Reed, author of Birth in Focus with the beautiful photographs, and Dennis Walsh.
Yeah, Associate Professor Dennis Walsh, he's coming. Very excited.
So you posted an article from Dennis. Do you want to tell us about that?
He's heading the team that's doing the research, looking at how midwifery-led units stand alone and alongside are performing in the context of, now it gets a little bit complicated, I think, those women in that area that come into the category of low risk, what portion of those women are going through midwifery-led units for the whole of their birth experience? And the range is from about 3% to 30% is the top of the range. But the report in question is a preliminary report, which was just looking at the spread of maternity midwifery-led units across the country. And there's still 25% of hospitals that don't even have a midwifery-led component to their service provision.
Right, because that's one of the central tenets of, was it the Better Birthing Report?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Shared by Baroness Cumberland.
That women should have choice of all four options.
Four options?
Yeah, obstetric, alongside midwifery units, freestanding midwifery unit, and home.
Oh, yeah, fair comment.
Which one were you not thinking of?
No, four, you're right.
Just unable to count to four. I know, it's tricky.
I think there are tensions with the agenda of better birth. You know, because we've known the evidence about midwifery-led units has been there for years. Dennis has been writing about it for 30 years. But there does seem to be tension between standalone units and centrally managed units. You know, up and down the country, standalone units are under threat because of their numbers of referrals. And there are all kinds of local political reasons for that. But still, there are areas of the country that have no alongside midwifery unit provision or standalone provision.
And do you think the threat, you say, because of referrals, is that, do you mean because they just don't have many numbers coming in?
I think, and I don't have any inside information, but I think that it's to do with referral patterns, that where there are plans in cities like mine, Leicester, to close down the standalone unit and to merge two units into one, there is kind of like a central drive towards merging everything, even though the data, you know, the research data is pointing towards actually decentralizing, you know, intermediary-led units, standalone and alongside. But of course, fiscally, it may not make any sense in the short term to do that. You know, when you're struggling to staff one unit, for goodness sake, and suddenly you are fragmenting your workforce to standalone units or alongside units.
Yeah.
You know, Kathy Warwick's article feeds into this nicely, because she's pointing to the lack of numbers when it comes to midwifery students, and saying that, you know, our workforce is aging. We've not got enough younger midwives coming in. So we have a service where the birth rate is going up, the numbers of midwives aren't sufficient. We have evidence that suggests that providing other options away from the centre is where the good outcomes potentially lie, but we don't have the resources to fund that.
Yeah. So this is Kathy Warwick in The Telegraph on 7th of February. The challenges facing midwifery are immense. No wonder we have a crisis on our hands.
Yeah.
And to talk more about that midwifery crisis, let's listen to Elizabeth. So this is Elizabeth Duff from NCT.
So my name is Elizabeth Duff. I'm a senior policy advisor at NCT, which is a charity for people expecting a baby or in the first 2 years. And what we've done over the last year or so is join with a fantastic partner organisation, the National Federation for Women's Institutes. And we devised a survey for women who've had a baby in about the previous 2.5 years, and sent it out through all our networks.
And what were you asking about?
We wanted to know about their experience of having a baby in the NHS, and we were looking for things that had not gone well and looking for things that had gone well. We're particularly interested in knowing whether the current midwifery workforce is actually sufficient and able to give the quality of care that they should be. We were looking out for other things that have been emphasised in recent maternity policy, like the importance of continuity of carer, which is women really being able to get to know their midwife or a really small team of midwives.
Mm-hmm. And presumably communication between those different parties.
Exactly. We've looked at the concept of continuity in a lot of depth, and there are a lot of ways looking at it, everything from being literally the same person looking after you all the way through, which we do appreciate is very difficult in the NHS, though some midwives working independently manage to do that. But the very, very basic level of continuity is making sure that women have consistent information. And we did unfortunately find a few women postnatal period getting different stories from their different caregivers about things like infant feeding, which left them even more bewildered, confused and unhappy than they were, which in some cases was quite considerable. So that was a big theme of what we were looking for. Also, whether women had the choice that they've been guaranteed in policy of things like where to give birth, but also, in a way, there were some quite, in a sense, more minor things, but whether they had choice about something like the level of lighting in the room where they were in labour. And there were just little stories like women who really wanted to be labouring in quite a dark room in reduced light. And every time the midwife came in, she put the light up full. And we think choice of women over their environment is actually a really important thing. It can give them the confidence that they've got the power. It's their pregnancy, it's their labour, and they're able to own it and have their choices met.
So they have a sense of control over their environment.
Exactly.
But also that. They're able to provide themselves with conditions that are nice, safe, oxytocin-inducing.
Precisely, yes. There's a nice little quote somewhere in our report of a woman who was actually saying she didn't have continuity in labour, and it was a different set of midwives who looked after her, and at first she found that quite worrying, but she said they were excellent, established a relationship very quickly, and she described herself as being very soon relaxed and reassured. And I think those two words are so incredibly important for women in labour. If they can feel relaxed and reassured that they're getting good care from a competent and compassionate midwife, that's great. If you can get continuity, of course, it's much more likely that women feel relaxed and reassured right from the beginning. And that's the perfect way to do it.
So these were the main themes coming out, the inconsistent postnatal care, lack of choice, and then sort of lack of continuity during the antenatal and birth.
That's right. And we were looking for those events that are described as red flag events. That's a definition provided by NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, which describes certain events, which is usually women receiving the care that they should, but delayed. So that was quite a considerable theme here.
So that was things like waiting for pain medication and stitching and things like that.
Yes, exactly. Yes. All sorts of medication, including pain relief, including antibiotics, including other drugs, I think, like women who've had surgery who need to have medication against the risk of blood clotting, things like that, that really do have to be timely. Otherwise, they're not going to work, and that raises the risk. So it's really disturbing to hear that what should be a relatively simple thing, like a woman given a tablet and a glass of water and asked to swallow it, just isn't happening. And some mothers were having to get up out of bed, and maybe after a cesarean, and go and find the midwife and say, shouldn't I be having my medication now? And of course, with others, it was missed because they didn't even realise that that should have been happening.
So what did you manage to get to the root of, or come up with theories about why these things are happening?
We're pretty certain that these very near unsafe events are happening because there are dangerously low staffing levels. And that is mainly in midwifery. But we know that among obstetricians, there are also a lot of gaps in the rotas that they should have to provide medical backup all the time, that women are getting good care from maternity support workers who are also trained to do a lot of the jobs around looking after women, but they are not qualified midwives, and it's essential that a support worker always has a midwife supervising. And of course, the more different people there are around, the less continuity there is. So it is pretty clear. The sort of comments we got from women, typically, I'm literally reading one now, the midwives were all fantastic, but all completely run off their feet. And another one that said the staff on the ward were incredible, but despite being critically understaffed. So that was really an overwhelmingly emerging theme, that mums felt the care that they got was great, but it was too little and in some cases too late.
Yeah.
Not the midwife's fault, but because they were a midwife who wanted to go on providing care, say after the baby was born, but was pulled away to rush off and look after another woman, probably in labour.
Yeah, I'm on RMSLC and we talk to women and they say those exact things. They'll yes. say, we couldn't fault the care, the staff were excellent, but you can see that they're run off their feet, there just aren't enough of them.
Yes, and that's really takes us through to the postnatal care problems, which start, of course, almost immediately the baby's born. One woman was describing the fact that she was left in the same bed as she'd given birth. She wasn't even helped to wash. She didn't get the stitches that she was due to have for a long time. And obviously, apart from the distress and discomfort that's going to arise from a situation like that is going to increase the risk of infection, which is exactly what you don't want at any time, but particularly for a new mum with a new baby.
And I've just seen a tweet from a little while ago commenting that leaving women in pain and alone is a breach of their human rights.
It is. I agree, and that we don't want to be the people who are saying to a midwifery workforce, you are taking human rights away from women. But it is the system, the lack of resources, the fact that midwives in many places are so overstretched that is resulting in those situations, which are essentially, yes, women feeling alone, abandoned and in pain.
So where can we go from here? What happens next to improve this situation?
Well, I think there are positive things going on. As you probably know, there was a policy document called Better Births, published about a year ago. That was for England, and we must remember that our survey covered Wales as well, but the majority of respondents were from England. And there is a lot going on to address the recommendations of Better Births. The recommendations included better continuity. They do include better postnatal care, though I think this is an area that still needs to be pushed for and pushed for, because it doesn't seem to be of the highest profile among the schemes that are going ahead to try and get those recommendations in.
I guess it's a very difficult one to fix if there simply aren't midwives on the ground.
I think you're right. The assumption often seems to be that postnatal care can be the area that is eroded by midwives being called away to come and work on a labour ward. And of course, on a labour ward, it's absolutely essential that each woman has a midwife with her. But if you look overall at what the dangerous things that can happen around maternity, and I wouldn't want to focus on the very distressing topic of maternal deaths, because they are very few in this country and generally maternity care is safe, but 80% of maternal deaths happen in the postnatal period, and in the NHS budgets it's only around 8% of the budget that goes to postnatal care. So we do feel there's a mismatch there. There's a lot being said about safety, including the Secretary of State for Health, who we know is really keen on safety, and that's great. But we do feel he needs to look a bit more at what happens after the baby is born.
Is that because if incidents happen during birth, then it's easy to point a finger and say this is what happened and this is who's to blame, and postnatally it's all a little bit more... it's multifactorial, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. And I think that is the problem. The care moves very quickly from the labour ward and perhaps the obstetrician, and then the postnatal ward, which are really, I must say, postnatal ward is a situation that is legendary for being chaotic, understaffed, really a pretty uncomfortable experience for most women. And so they want to get out of hospital and they go home expecting to have midwifery visits. And these are sometimes only one, or occasionally not even one home visit, which I think is absolutely essential. We're really asking for two home visits for all women so that the midwife can actually get an idea of what's happening as the postnatal days go on and make sure that the woman who may look very uncomfortable and bewildered on day one or two, by the time it gets to perhaps a week later, she is moving on and is beginning to look as though she's really coping. So there are lots of physical problems that can turn up with women. There are mental health problems that can occur over the early weeks, and sometimes, as we know, that can exacerbate into really serious depression. So there's a lot of things going on. There are different caregivers, most of whom are under great pressure, the postnatal midwives, the health visitors, GPs who are trying to, if you like, welcome a new mum back into primary care, but sometimes without even the information of what's being discovered during their pregnancy. We hear quite a lot about women now who go into pregnancy believing that they're well. And indeed, in most ways, they are. But they're then perhaps diagnosed with gestational diabetes, or they're discovered to have a hypertensive disorder, so a problem with their blood pressure, or something else like that, and they're given medication and expected to attend medical appointments, and then they have the baby and they're home with dealing with a new baby with all the stress and anxiety and sleep deprivation that can come with that. And many of them don't know whether they need more medical appointments or they need to keep taking medication and where they should get their prescriptions from, and whether this means they're actually going to be ill for the rest of their lives or it's something that goes away. And unfortunately, I think this is getting to be a growing problem, partly because women are, on average, getting older when they have their families. And these different conditions are somewhat more likely to occur with older women in their 30s and 40s.
So there's going to be possibly an increase in this kind of postnatal illness, and women also being more isolated, perhaps.
I think so. It's something that our organisation, the NCT, is, I hope, quite well known for. Making sure that women don't feel isolated in their weeks and months as a new parent. They're brought together with other people in the neighbourhood. They can join an NCT branch. Those women who do antenatal classes nearly always get together afterwards, but there's lots of opportunities for those who haven't done a class, because we have a whole range of events, bumps and babies get together and coffee mornings and drop-ins to help with baby feeding and other problems, nearly new sales where you can get rid of the baby grows and so on that you don't want and buy some new ones at discounts. So a lot going on there.
There are some areas where NCT is reaching out to the kind of non-NCT demographic, like the work in Leeds.
Absolutely.
The refugee There's families.
An increasing amount going on. We've had for years and years now been supporting women who are refugees or asylum seekers in Leeds. We've got another project doing that in Wolverhampton, and we are trying to spread all these projects as much as we can. We're training peer supporters in their own communities now to help women who are suffering from mental health problems. And that is, with the people we're training are those who've been through that same experience. So it's a very much a woman-to-woman peer support. We've worked with the Institute of Health Visiting to make sure that training is really valid, evidence-based, doing the right things for those women and being able to steer them to other services when they need it.
I think there's a huge amount to be said about what NCT does postnatally that just doesn't often get said.
Well, I'm glad we've had the opportunity to say a bit about it now. And as you rightly say, we are making huge efforts now to reach out to those women who may not feel that an antenatal class is what they need or the right thing for them, or perhaps haven't heard about NCT until after they've had their baby. But parenthood goes on for quite a long time, I've noticed.
Doesn't it?
It doesn't really matter. Our main remit is to work for parents until their baby is about two. But we know very well that we still have members who are looking after their babies who are over 30 and having their own babies. So, as I say, parenthood goes on.
That's lovely. Thank you so much for your time, Elizabeth. It's been really interesting.
Thanks very much, Karen. Bye-bye.
That seems to highlight all the things we've been saying so far, Karen.
Yeah.
You know, and I spend quite a lot of time with student midwives, you know, hundreds probably up and down the country. And it bemuses me that thinking people can decide to cut the bursary for student midwifery training.
Again, just completely short-sighted.
It just bemuses me. You know, in the light of what Cathy Warwick is saying about diminishing numbers of student midwives, it's going to take a generation to get up to the numbers that we require given the birth rate, right?
Yeah.
And you know, I went to Huddersfield and I spoke to their new intake of student midwives, a range of women, right, across kind of social spheres, you know, demographic spheres and ages from different backgrounds. And the amount of those women who told me that without the bursary, they wouldn't have applied.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have been able to. They were either single mothers or they were older women who wouldn't have had the finances to even consider being midwives. Now that's going to be a detriment to us as a profession.
Yes.
Obviously, just because of the nuances and the colour that having women of all ages coming into midwifery brings. But if you just look at it on a pure numbers level, it's madness.
Yeah, it's just not going to work. So you're right. Demographically speaking, we need this huge range, and midwives are going to be more and more just the sort of, I don't know, older women who can afford to train.
I think it will be younger women who come in from A-levels who are willing to take on £60,000 worth of debt to train. You know, they could probably do anything, right?
Mm.
They could probably pursue investment banking, anything, because they are the cream of the academic crop in many ways, and they are choosing to serve birthing women. And that's beautiful. So not to diminish them, it's just an acknowledgement that we need a broad range of women choosing to go into midwifery. And you're right, it will attract some older women that have the economic resources. But by and large, I think it will lead to a younger, newly qualified midwife cohort.
Yeah. It's depressing, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. But I think you have to have a sense of hope and optimism about the future.
Yes. Shall we change the subject?
Yeah, go on.
Shall we talk about Pride and Joy?
Oh, you wrote a review of this book.
I really loved it. Have you read it?
Yeah, well, I haven't read it cover to cover, but
we know what that means. The dog ate your homework.
No, not at all. Thoroughly dipped into it, you know, so read whole chapters and found the book moving.
Yeah.
I found the book confronting in terms of confronting my pre-existing ideas about what constitutes family. And
In what way?
There's a couple whose name I can't remember and can't find in the book, where he is now openly gay, but in a relationship with the woman he married before he came out as being gay, and their experience of parenting in that context. It just opened me up to other people's lives.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't have access in my personal network of friendships.
Right.
And that's one of the values of the book. The book is evidential, because as you read it, you start to resonate with the stories of people. It forms your map of the world, you know, where your map was kind of impoverished because you hadn't heard a human being expressing these kinds of feelings and thoughts in the context that they do in the book. It kind of expanded my world. I would actively recommend anyone within the LGBT community to engage with the book. I love the way each chapter has top tips.
Yeah, I really liked the structure of the book. It was very readable, and I'm recommending it all over the place. I found it interesting because obviously there are issues that are unique to those particular families, but so many things are unique to one family, and it's more about finding strategies that are good for a range of different things. And I thought you could broaden it out to other families that are not the norm.
Yeah.
And there are so many. And in fact, not being the norm is almost the norm now, isn't it? Because an extended family, blended and divorced, and even we as a family with only one child are not the norm.
The whole idea of the norm is rooted in a sort of like a collective hallucination about what's acceptable. You know, it's what's standard. There's no such thing, is there?
No. The two parents and two children and one dog or whatever it is not really the standard family anymore.
No. Yeah, we're talking about Pride and Joy, a guide for lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans parents. It's published by our sponsor, Pinter and Martin. It's an extraordinary read. And to be honest, it reminded me of our episode that we did on the LGBT community. And when I was looking for books to research in the London bookshop, almost all of them were written in an American context.
Yeah. Oh, it would have been brilliant to interview these two, wouldn't it?
Well, I think you should.
We will put them on the list.
Yeah, it's Sarah and Rachel Hager-Holt.
Okay, great book. And don't forget that if you're buying from Pinter & Martin, you can use the voucher code SPROGCAST at the checkout for a 10% discount. And I also want to just say hi to Elizabeth from the Garden Sanctuary, tweeting us at Sanctuary Doula, who seems to have allowed SPROGCAST to take over her life.
A lot of people listen to us when they're walking the dog.
They do, don't they? Okay, so we have an interesting interview coming up. This is with Dr. Margaret McCartney, and it's not specifically relevant to maternity services, but obviously all that she says can be generalised to include maternity services within her comments on the state of the NHS. So shall we listen to her?
Yeah, let's get her on.
I'm introducing once again Margaret McCartney, who is joining the select number of people who've been on the podcast twice. And she's going to talk about her book, The State of Medicine, published, of course, by Pinter & Martin. Hi, Margaret. Thank you for giving us some more time. Well, as a person in the middle of your book, I fully appreciate how busy you are.
Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. So I'm halfway through your book, which I'm really enjoying.
Good. There's a mixture of responses. I've had people sort of saying, you know, I enjoyed it, but I was just so angry.
Yeah.
Which was as part, you know, I suppose that's a big part of what I'm looking for, is for people to find out what's going on and then to have some emotional response to it.
Yeah, as I said, enjoying, I thought that's the wrong word. It's making me quite upset.
In a useful way, I hope.
Yeah, and in a sort of kind of, well, yeah, I know this. Way.
Yeah.
And it is set out so beautifully clearly. When my alarm goes off in the morning, Radio 4 comes on.
Yeah.
So every single day I hear these stories about how the NHS is being systematically undermined. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. And it's been undermined by the governance of the NHS. That's the tragedy of it. You know, so it is the mechanisms that are meant to protect and ensure the NHS's longevity are the very institutions which are undermining it at its core. And that's what I can't bear more than anything. The NHS is being made to fail out of the political choices that are being made, not because it has to fail. That's what frustrates and infuriates me so much.
It seems like the decisions being made are very politically driven.
Yeah, I mean, anyone can make a mistake. You know, mistakes are part of being human. We all make errors that we regret and we'd like to change. The problem is that the NHS does not have mechanisms set up that allows it to systematically learn from errors and stop repeating them in the area of policy making. So we have people repeating things that we already know don't work because they've been tried. It's been a wasteful and huge drain in expenses before. And yet our politicians are happy to go ahead again and do more or less the same thing. You know, and it is just crazy. It's not a good use of money, and more than that, it's not a good use of morale. You know, the NHS runs most of the time very well because of the vocation and commitment of the people that work in it. You know, from porters to nurses to receptionists to doctors, physiotherapists, you know, people that tend to work in the NHS tend to do the job and more because of a love of it, because they feel as though they're making a difference, they're doing something that counts. And you mean, there's so many great stories, and part of what I've done in the book is I've tried to capture some stories of people who've either worked for, in or around, or been a patient of the NHS, to try and explain that I think we have an emotional bond to the NHS. It's about humanity and the way we express our humanity. And instead of the government appreciating this for what wonderful thing it is that you have humans that want to help other humans, instead of the government appreciating this and wanting to assist and help people do their best and then better, instead, that verification is being undermined. You know, we saw, for example, the 7-day NHS policy. Not based on evidence, based on lies, mistruths, exaggerations, cherry picking of evidence, you know, just the most appalling way to make policy put in. And there's now a generation of junior doctors who feel worse than unloved, who feel despised, I think, by government, who feel as though their feelings and emotions have been treated so badly, who feel as though they've been accused of being lazy, not working at the weekends, not interested in helping patients. You're really undermining the sense of humanity that I think drives the NHS, and I think we have just underappreciated, certainly in the last decade or decade and a half of practice.
And do you think that's deliberate? I mean, this policy making this kind of inability to change things that clearly don't work, it could be stupidity.
Well, I mean, I don't really think it is, because there's no excuse. I mean, these are not stupid people, you know, and I don't really believe there's that very many stupid people. Instead, I think that there are people who are willfully ignorant of evidence and who have philosophies that will change the way that they choose to look at evidence or expertise or systematic reviews, who decide that they're not going to look at, you know, they're going to have some form of bias, I suppose, in the way that they interpret things or use things, or are not open to having people who are experts assisting them to look at that evidence, because it can often be complicated. And, you know, I was speaking to someone the other day and saying, actually, I trust doctors more when they tell me I'm not sure I'm going to go and have them check, because they're realizing that no one can know everything. Everyone can learn something from somebody else. And it is useful to go and fact check yourself, go and find out, what is the latest information? Am I sure that I know enough about this subject matter? What are the gaps in my knowledge that I'm not even aware of? And instead of our policymakers at a political level saying, well, actually, I'm not sure about things, let's go and check, let's have a look in an unbiased fashion at the evidence, instead we're getting really short-term, vote-friendly policies driven through that if anyone had just looked back a little bit or paid attention to what other departments in government, non-political departments of government, were saying, we would never have done it. You know, here's a good example is of dementia screening. This was one of a recent idea that our politicians had. They wanted to drive up the number of dementia diagnoses, and what they wanted GPs to do was to screen people when they came to see them for something else about their memory. And, you know, in the face of it, that might seem like a good idea. Why would you want to know? Why shouldn't doctors do that? And they incentivise doctors with money basically for making more diagnoses. But in fact, the screening tests that are used are notoriously inaccurate. And the UK National Screening Committee has always said, don't screen for dementia. It's an inaccurate test that leads to lots and lots of false positives and false negatives. Don't do it, it shouldn't be done. And instead of government saying, well, actually, let's just look and see what the people who we are paying to supply us with expert evidence are saying, they just drove ahead with this really damaging policy that wastes money, annoys patients, because very many patients complained about it, and I think frustrated and drove down the morale of doctors who felt as though they were struggling financially in many areas. You know, the money on the table was being offered for this, and many doctors didn't want to do it because they felt it was unethical.
And presumably does that thing where it's directing resources at the well.
Yes, it doesn't. The resources don't go to the people that really do need them, who are almost inevitably people who have more severe memory symptoms, who do have dementia, and who need usually quite high amounts of social care. And instead, we've got this absolute battering of the social care budget, the care assistants that would do huge amounts of work, backbreaking work often, looking after people with long-term conditions that they're not going to improve from. And rather than these people being paid well, cherished, instead they've been given targets they've got to get from to be very quickly, they're paid a minimum wage or sometimes not even that. So we have it, I think, really the wrong way around. And my concern is very much that this early diagnosis was there to drive increased prescribing of medications that don't work very well for dementia, rather than actually targeting resources that people most likely to benefit with social care, which is in the end what most people with more severe disease really did need or do need.
So are you saying that's kind of industry-driven policy making, where somebody at the end of it stands to make money?
The other example is telehealth. So telehealth was this big idea, and there was lots of publicity driven around saying, you know, all we need is technology, you know, technology will save us. And the government went ahead and spent huge amounts, millions of pounds, on these black boxes to put in people's homes, supposedly to monitor them. But when the data came up, of course, it showed that it only worked to a small extent in very specific cases, which actually was already known about. And it didn't make a big difference for a huge amount of people. So again, that's a huge amount of waste that was completely unnecessary, because the research wasn't put in place before the money was spent. And that's a bad thing to do. And again, it doesn't put resources where people will benefit from them.
Yeah, I've noticed a recurring theme in your book where policies aren't trialled.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with trials being done and then you finding something that you thought did work doesn't work. That's good science.
That would be very right.
Well, exactly. And instead, the opposite happens. For example, health checks, that's the other sort of thing that just repeatedly drives me crazy. And that was actually a Gordon Brown initiative. And the idea was you would have a health checkup, you'd be entitled to one, the NHS would provide this for you. And superficially, it seems great. Why wouldn't you want a health checkup? But actually, the data shows that it doesn't make a big difference or any difference at all. And there's been very good trials done that actually show this is not a good way of spending money. It actually doesn't reduce a mortality or morbidity. What a useful set of circumstances where you make policy would do is go and look and see what does the evidence tell us and then stop doing things that don't work. But instead, we've continued with this health check scheme. We've continued doing it. It's been rolled out to more and more places. There's duplication of results. There's more paperwork for GPs. Well patients are tending to go for them more often than unwell patients. So you tend to end up with more resources going to the people less likely to benefit from them. And the health inequalities, I think, are actually may well end up being worse rather than better because of this. But there's no need for it to have happened. There was no need for any of that to have happened if only people had been grown up enough to say, OK, let's look, is this a good use of resources right at the very beginning? We wouldn't be in the mess that we're in now.
And is this because, like some of our politicians tell us, we're all tired of experts and we know better anyway? So it's basically if you put your finger in the air and come up with a good idea, you could do that.
It's a really interesting, I suppose, an interesting problem in terms of where we go from now with the way that we view experts and expert evidence. And I think it's really important that, and there's been a lot of effort went in to make sure that more people have more access to better information about healthcare. But again, there's evidence that says actually most people will change their mind based on anecdotal stories as opposed to hard facts. So, and the evidence around this itself is not full, but there are concerns, I think, that people are not won over by statistics. Many people are concerned or suspicious of statistics, no matter how they're presented or who are presenting them. So there's another issue, and I'm very worried about, obviously, the Trump administration and their attitude towards vaccination, for example. I'm very concerned that what you might is what David Colquhoun memorably calls an indarkenment, where instead of being enlightened by science and the scientific method, actually we go back and we go backwards and we start to see resurgence of hugely preventable diseases. And in medicine, we know that when we give people really high quality evidence and we give them information in ways that are useful and easier to understand in shorter periods of time, we know that in general people want less medicine and people tend to feel happier with the decisions that we make. So I think there's lots of stuff attached to how we give people high quality information, and I don't even think the science of that has even really began to unfold properly.
Yes, it's that area of health behaviour and decision making.
And a
lot of people listening working in maternity services, that's really big for us.
And I suppose that there's another intersection about how we use decision making in terms of policy. And I can understand that in policy within the NHS, and I can understand that politicians feel as though they are democratically elected and therefore they are responsible and they want to shape the direction of travel. But I think the NHS is a little bit different in that it's something that all political parties agree on. And even UKIP seems to agree that the NHS should be there at the point of need and should be sustained in the long term. So there is this kind of agreement. And so to me, the question is, and that's a question I tried to answer in the book, is how do we sustain the NHS in the long term? And I suppose that what I'm interested in is how we shape the structure of making decisions about the NHS in the long term. So if you have this agreement from the electorate who say that they're immensely proud of the NHS and they want to keep it, if you have an agreement from the elected representatives who say, at least on the surface, we want the NHS to remain our national health service. So then how do you do that? And I don't think you can do it in any other way other than working out a non-party political process for ensuring that the decisions made about policy are based on evidence. So much that we have that has done damage to the NHS has been born out of short-term political policy. The Health and Social Care Act, for example, an absolute disaster which the government of the day said wasn't going to happen but then did, and has wasted a vast amount of money, millions of pounds worth of money in the process. Private finance initiatives, we find that hospitals are massively now in the red, trying desperately to pay back hugely bad deals that they had. We had independent sector treatment centres set up as a kind of competition towards the NHS that were going to somehow drive up quality and bring down prices. Well, that didn't work, and there was no evidence it was ever going to work. And instead, it's created financial black holes all over the place. The Cancer Drugs Fund, for example, and that was really a way to subvert NICE. And NICE started off as a humane way to try and make transparent or more transparent decisions around drugs funding, and instead the Cancer Fund really subverted that, and the National Audit Office found that there was really no good evidence that that money was being spent in a high quality way. And we have huge private sector profiteering going on that the NHS is not protected from. We have all sorts of private companies who are offering health checks and screenings and then just tossing the results back to the NHS to get sorted out after, of course, they've walked away with the money. We saw, the silicon breast implant industry passing back all the faulty implants and the problems connected with that to the NHS. We still have homeopathic hospitals within the NHS and a part-time spiritual healer somewhere. You know, huge amounts of waste that go on from the sublime to the ridiculous, really. And to me, the bottom line problem is that we haven't worked out a coherent way of making sure that evidence goes first. That's what I'm really arguing for. And I'm just trying to explain in the first bit of the book why it is that we have to move forward with that. You know, so you've got this humane endeavour, this meeting, I suppose, of science and vocation within the NHS. And you have people who are motivated to do their best, but they need to be asked to do things that are of value, not of things that are of no consequence or are wasteful. When it comes towards the end of the book, I hope you will see my arguments for how you could do that in a non-party political manner.
So I'm going to feel more positive by the time I get to the end.
Oh, absolutely.
You're going good. To I'll go and read some more of it now then. You have to go. Thanks so much. It's really nice to talk to you again. Maybe we'll get you back.
Again. Oh, exciting. Okay, thanks so much. Okay, bye for now.
Thanks, Margaret. Bye. Bye.
It's a salutary message, isn't it? You know, the idea that the NHS is under threat from outside influences that, you know, that are seeking, you know, maybe for commercial gain, to see the demise of it, and it would be a sad day.
It's so frustrating the lack of rigour in the way things are, the way new policies are implemented. What she's talking about, how the way things don't get piloted, it's just done for the sake of a headline. And yeah. I mean, I'd like to think the best of our health professionals and assume that they are all good at using the evidence when they make policy decisions or, you know, treatment decisions or whatever. But it just seems like they're being managed by people who haven't got a clue.
Yeah. Well, we've already spoken about the decision with bursaries. That doesn't seem to make any sense.
No.
Whichever way you look at it. So, you know, I think maybe we sometimes invest our political leaders with more intelligence than they have.
I don't.
Oh, good.
Right. Let us know what you think. Join the discussion. We're on Facebook and Twitter.
Get in touch. We love to hear what you think about what we've said. And we also are very open to ideas about up and coming episodes. We plan 6 months ahead, but we're always willing to respond to requests.
That's a lie about planning 6 months ahead. But we do know that our next episode is going to be about miscarriage and abortion. And we've got a guest from the British Pregnancy Advisory Service and possibly somebody else as well. So we're looking forward to putting that one together for you. And it'll be out on the 25th of April.
I think we should definitely mention the series of talks that they're in the middle of at Pinter & Martin, conducted by Michel Audon. You know, in my career as a midwife, he has been so influential. You know, the early books that I read were written by him. Do you know, I know he's in good health, but he's not as young as he was. And if you want to hear him, that sounds terrible. If you want to hear...
It's not 2016 anymore, Mark. He'll be fine.
Yeah, true.
So go and see Michel Audon while you still can. What a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah, go and see him. He's amazing. And although I have some differences in how he expresses some of his opinions, he's brilliant.
Thank you. So that, I think, is all we have time for today.
Oh.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Before you go, have a listen to this story from James.
So my name's James Brackenbury.
Hi, James. And you've got a story for us.
I have got a story for you, yeah. We had a baby in November. So after getting hold of Mark's book, I started reading through that. And first of all, I was amazed that in my life, now that I'm 29, I don't really read a lot. But Mark's book was brilliant. It's really one of the only books I can remember in recent time that I've read cover to cover. At the start of the process, before we met the doula, I felt that I had an idea of what to expect, as I've been through the process before with my ex-partner. And to a point, it's a certain amount of intuition and kind of going with your gut feeling. But obviously, there's a certain amount of uncertainty with that. But certainly from reading all the context and the words and getting a better understanding of what was expected from me and how best to act and to trust in the natural birthing process helped me feel more confident that I could be in the room to be the support for my partner. And actually it helped her to believe that I was able to be there to support her, because she wanted a very much a hands-off birth with plenty of sort of breathing space, no drugs or as minimal drugs as possible. And she needed to trust that I was going to support her through that, which obviously I was able to do after reading and understanding everything that was there. The birth itself was amazing. We went to hospital in the end at 4 o'clock in the morning, and our son was born at 10 to 10. So it all went quite quickly.
Yeah. Had you planned to give birth in hospital?
Yeah, we went onto a midwifery-led ward, which is what we really wanted, because we didn't want too many sort of interruptions from doctors. We had a really great unit very close to us that we ended up not using. We actually went a bit further afield because he was a bit overdue, the baby. So they wouldn't allow us to this one hospital, but we had to go to another. And actually, it turned out to be a much nicer room. The environment itself was wonderful, the actual birthing room.
What was so good about it?
It had its own bathroom connected to the room, and in the bathroom it had a massive bath in it. It also had places to, it had like a hanging rope so that she could hang up against it. It was a really large sofa. It felt very, very homely, and I think that ultimately it was a better environment to birth in rather than a normal sort of labour ward. There was very little machinery, for medical side of things. It was just really cosy and homely and comfortable to be in. They didn't mind us adding our own touches to it either. So I put some fairy lights up and we had some music playing, and it was just really lovely in the end.
Did you feel safe there?
Felt very safe, and actually felt confident in the midwife that we had. She completely got where we were coming from and respected that, and she would only come in if we needed her there or if she was passing to see if we needed any more tea or anything like that. It was a really lovely environment. The labour was quite amazing in that from about 8 o'clock contractions then started, and then it really sort of ramped up quite quickly, and I think the intensity of it, because I think the intensity was would have put a lot of people off and started to make them panic. But I completely had every faith that things were going as they should have been. She told me that she was starting to push, that's when the midwife came in to actually make sure that everything was going well. And in actual fact, I think she was a lot more comfortable in that situation because she was confident that I knew that she could do it, if that made sense.
Yeah.
We also had her mother with us as well. And she's quite sort of spiritual. She's a Reiki master. So that was quite nice to have that whole atmosphere going on in the room was really lovely as well.
She had your partner had quite a lot of support.
Yes, yeah. So we had JR doula, but we didn't see her very much. We saw her a month before the baby was born. And then after that, it was just kind of we were getting ourselves ready and getting ready to go.
Was she there at the birth?
She wasn't. No, she did come to see us afterwards because she lived quite a distance from the hospital. We didn't feel that we needed her there, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah.
We felt quite mentally prepared as a couple, which was good, I think.
Yeah, it sounds like you were both very calm and very confident.
Yes, yeah. And literally all she had towards the end was, because she found it becoming so intense so quickly, she had a bit of Pepcid towards the end. But that was literally 9:30, and he was born 10 or 15 minutes later, so it really didn't have much time to kick in.
So how were those first few minutes with your son?
It was wonderful. It was really lovely. He was delivered. I just remember looking at him because he was really, really quiet for a moment. And then all of a sudden he just took his first breath. And then we did a bit of skin-to-skin time with mum, with the cord still attached, for about 15 minutes, just to let everything sort of flow through. And it was just wonderful. As soon as he was born, midwife placed Max on mum, and she just said, "I'm just going to leave you guys to it. You know what you're doing." She left us for 15 minutes. She came back in, cut the cord, and left us again. And we were just left to just kind of bond with baby and make get mum comfortable. And then an hour later, they came back in and just changed the bed down and got us all comfortable. But we left the hospital at 7 o'clock that evening, so we weren't in for very long. Me and mum, we went off for some lunch around about 12:30, just a little bit on cloud nine, really. It's quite incredible.
That sounds amazing.
It really was. Yeah, it was really lovely. Completely different to my last experience, which was wonderful, really. That was a long labour in the end, and it resulted in a C-section. But this labour was completely different.
Yeah.
It really was.
Did you feel like you'd prepared differently this time?
Absolutely. Yeah, I felt that I was completely prepared this time, whereas before I just didn't know what was going on. And the only insight that I had of what to expect could have come from one born every minute, which sometimes gives the wrong sort of idea of what's happening, because depending on which hospital they're at, they can be quite sort of quick for surgery and such like, whereas actually just trusting in the natural human body of it all, and everything seems to happen.
Yeah, you kept the lid on all of that.
Yes, yeah, and keep the adrenaline down and try and keep her happy and feeling safe and not panic her. So
yeah, that's great. Thanks so much. It's a lovely story.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye. You've been listening to Sprogcast with Mark Harris and Karen Hall. Sprogcast is supported by Pinter and Martin. For all your pregnancy, birth, breastfeeding and parenting reading, check out pinterandmartin.com and enter the code Sprogcast for an additional 10% off. Sprogcast is produced by Karen Hall with technical assistance by Pete Hall, and our branding is provided by Nick Hilditch.